Thanks for listening to this message from the life of St. Bees. We're a church that loves to empower, equip, and inspire. And in order to better fulfill this call, we're currently undertaking an audacious church relocation project. Find out more, including how you can take part, at www.goandgrow.london. Thank you, and may this message better help you to live a life full of adventurous faith.
Today, so if you haven't got one, go and grab one. You can grab a drink at the same time if you are feeling thirsty. Grab a Bible. If you've got it on your phone, that's fine too, but you're going to need the text in front of you. So take a moment to do that, and I'm just going to do some stage adjustments here. Great. Oh, thanks, Lawrence. So if anyone needs a Bible, you can put your hand up. Lawrence is going to bring you one. How about that? And Pete. We good? All set? Lovely. We're looking at the story of Jesus presented in the three synoptic gospels. Can you say synoptic with me? Synoptic. Everyone know what synoptic means, yeah? Syn as in same, optic as in looking. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all look at Jesus in a similar way. It's distinct from John. That's why we call it the synoptic gospels. So when you hear the word synoptic, I'm talking about Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the last part of this term, we've been looking at the story, the overall story of Jesus as presented in the Synoptic Gospels. And if you'd like an explanation of the purpose of this series, check out Henry's introductory sermon right at the beginning. You can have that, hear that online. We've reached round about the middle of the story, the middle of the story of Jesus as presented in the Synoptic Gospels. And the bit that I've pulled out for us to look at, because it's quite a big chunk, the bit that I've pulled out for us to look at is what we call in the biz the Transfiguration. Familiar with that phrase, Transfiguration? Some of you, others less so. It's in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, and in all three cases, it comes shortly before the most important question any human being has to answer. The most important question that any human being has to answer, and we're going to come back to that question later. I just want to pick up on a few things that Henry said in his introductory sermon that I referred to a moment ago. The Transfiguration, it's considered by some to be the most pivotal point in all three Synoptic Gospels, as picked up in this illustration, because it recalls Jesus' baptism at the beginning of the story, and it anticipates Jesus' crucifixion at the end. Did you like the way I did that with my hand? I can throw red circles anywhere I like. It anticipates his death at the end of the story of Jesus in the Synoptics. Now, you've noticed that all four Gospels, they read differently. I mean, John is very different to the Synoptics, but even Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they read differently. Yeah? You've noticed that? I mean, they're not carbon copies of each other. There's similarities and overlap, but they are quite distinct. And one of the reasons that all four gospel writers have their own distinctive account of Jesus is because all four gospel writers have their own particular agenda. They all want to present Jesus in a certain way. All presentations of Jesus are genuine and are accurate and are real, but they've all got their own angle on how they want to present Jesus. Yet in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all of them present the Transfiguration in much the same way. It's one of those bits in the Synoptics where it doesn't matter which gospel you read it, it's very, very similar. And the text either side of it is similar as well. So you've got a conversation about who Jesus is, in which Peter gives just the right answer. Next, you have a conversation about Jesus needing to die, in which Peter gives just the wrong answer. And then Peter, James, and John wander up into the hills to pray with Jesus, and there he is mysteriously transfigured before their eyes. So we're going to read it. We're in Mark 8. So if you turn with me to page, if you've got one of these, page 956. Page 956 in the Blue Bibles, otherwise Mark 8 on your phones or wherever you're looking at. We're going to begin at verse 27. Mark 8, beginning at verse 27. You all there? Super. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that, which is incredible, isn't it? "Guys, I want you to follow me and you're going to be my witnesses everywhere, but whatever you do, don't tell anyone about me." But we're going to come back to that later. Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Verse 31, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and that after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. Which, I mean, on anyone's scale, I mean, that's quite a sharp rebuke. "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Now let's jump to verse 2 of chapter 9. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were all so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them. And a voice came down from the cloud, "This is my son whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except for Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. I mean, we read this with the benefit of hindsight. This is actually happening for them in real time. They're like, "What's happening?" Verse 11. Then they asked him, "Why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him." Okay. So the transfigurations, all 3 synoptic gospels, and it's presented thematically in very similar ways, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I've got 4 questions for you, and we've already been in groups today, so I thought, okay, well, let's discuss these in groups. I think we've got time. So the people you're sitting next to, I want you to discuss these 4 questions. The first question is, how does the transfiguration echo Jesus' baptism? According to scholars, and I showed you that little triangle thing, it harks back, it reminds us of Jesus' baptism. So how is the first question I have for you. Similarly, if it's supposed to anticipate Jesus' death, this account that we've just read together, how? How does it anticipate Jesus' death? Ask each other. Third question is, why Moses and Elijah? Jesus is transfigured. Why Moses and Elijah there with him? Why do those 2 characters, of all the Old Testament characters, of all the people who could turn up, in fact, why Moses and Elijah at all? Why not just be transfigured? Why these 2 characters? Why have they come along and been part of this? And the fourth question I'd like you to discuss is, why were Peter, James, and John told not to tell anyone until after Jesus comes back to death? Does that sound, like interesting questions to you? You think you can have a good conversation about that? Kick that around just for 5 minutes in small groups. And John, could you pop on some music? And then we're going to feedback. And then I'm going to tell you what I think about those four questions. Sound okay? Great. I'm giving you my heart.
Feel the nations of the earth are shaking. There is no power that can match his grace. Lift up your head, lift up your eyes to see. All of creation is waiting and longing for sons and daughters to declare this truth. Lift up your head, lift up your voice and sing. He is alive, shining in the darkness. He is a hope, hope of all the nations. He is the light, he is the light for all the world to see.
We're just over halfway through the time, so if you've only dealt with the question one, that's fine, but you might like to get onto the other ones as well.
they came to mourn. The stone was rolled away, the veil was torn. For he had risen, he is the King of all the earth.
Okay, you wind up your conversations, we're going to come back. I've just looked at the clock actually, we are running a lot later than usual, so I'm probably going to have to just tell you some of the bits that I came up with, but I hope that was a helpful conversation. If any of you got anything that's really burning you want to call it out, please do. Can I tell you how I got on with those questions? Okay, how does the transfiguration echoes Jesus' baptism? There was the voice from heaven, wasn't there? Did you get that? Yeah, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased. listen to him, the voice from heaven, just like at Jesus' baptism. More subtly, you've got a reference to John the Baptist in the first book that we read together. Who do people say that I am? Some people say you're John the Baptist, and some people say you're Elijah or one of the prophets. So there's John the Baptist in the frame there, which the gospel readers think, I'm just going to remind them of Jesus' baptism done by John the Baptist. And then there's that whole conversation about Elijah, that mysterious conversation, which we're not going to get onto today, about Elijah as they're coming down the hill. And Elijah and John the Baptist are linked. So the gospel writers are wanting to say, this is important. Think back to Jesus' baptism. This is another really, really important part in our gospels. But it also anticipates Jesus' death. How did you get on with the question, how does the transfiguration point towards Jesus' death? This is what I thought. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, obviously, they all position it straight after when Jesus first begins to talk about dying and rising. And the disciples are like, what? What? No, not dying. Not dying, Jesus. You're going to be Messiah. You're going to help us and you're going to liberate us. And Jesus has to tell Peter off. So he's just beginning to talk about dying and rising. And in Mark, we have Jesus talking to them about his death on the way up a hill. So actually on the way down the hill, he's talking about their death. But did you notice, I mean, where was Jesus crucified? He was crucified on a hill. So little hints here saying this is supposed to help us think about Jesus' death as well. In Matthew and Luke's version, so you won't know this unless you really are incredible scholars. Emma, you probably know this, don't you? But actually, in the account, the disciples go up with Jesus. He then goes on ahead of them to pray on his own, and the disciples fall asleep. What does that remind you of? Where else did that happen? Gethsemane, that's right. So the gospel writers are wanting us to say his baptism's important, his death and resurrection's important, and the transfiguration anticipates both. This is a pinnacle moment in the story of Jesus as revealed in the gospels. Why is it so important, I wonder? We'll come to that in a bit. How did you get on with Moses and Elijah? I mean, why even have other people there? Well, Moses, what do we associate Moses with? Ten Commandments. The law, yeah, the law. Elijah, well, he's obviously a prophet, and he's supposed to make us think of the prophets of the Old Covenant. So we're reminded, as we see Moses, of the law of the Old Covenant. When we see Elijah, we think of the prophets of the Old Covenant. But why Elijah? I mean, there's a lot of prophets to choose from. There's a lot of people who, I mean, why not Isaiah? Why not Jeremiah? They have great, big, long prophecies that are recorded in the Jewish canon. This is what I came up with. Elijah is the prophet most readily associated in the first century with the Messiah. The second to last verse of the Jewish scriptures in Malachi, the very end of Malachi, Elijah is mentioned. And when you start talking about Elijah, you start thinking about the Messiah. And this is one of the reasons that John the Baptist is connected to Elijah. You talk about Elijah, you think about Messiah. So maybe that's the reason he was the prophet that appeared in the Transfiguration. It was Elijah who people were saying that Jesus might be when he asked his disciples, well, who are people saying that I am? Some people say you're John the Baptist. Some people say that you're Elijah. So I think maybe that's why Elijah was the one that appeared. But again, why? Okay, so Moses represents the law. Elijah represents the prophets, and in particular the prophets that we would connect with the Messiah most readily. But why have them at all? Jesus is being transfigured. And the reason he's being transfigured, transformed in this way, is to reveal who he really is. That's why this is such a central event. This is why it echoes his baptism, anticipates his death. It's right in the middle of the synoptics. The synoptic writers are wanting to say, this bit really, pay attention here. Even God says, listen to him. There's a big flag over this event. This bit really, really matters. Why? Because it reveals Jesus's true heavenly identity. Following a conversation where they're like, well, Jesus, lots of people think, obviously you're a big deal, but no one's quite sure who you are. Are you this? Are you that? Are you the other? And shortly after that, his true identity is revealed. But what have Moses and Elijah got to do with it? Why would Jesus be seen with people who symbolize the law and the prophets? Why would Jesus be seen, transfigured, exposed for who he really is, with one person who represents the law and another who represents the prophets? What was it Jesus said at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:17? He says, don't think I've come to do away with the law and the prophets. I've not come to do away with the law and the prophets. I've come to fulfill them. I've come to fulfill them. I am the fulfillment of everything that people have ever known by revelation in the Jewish scriptures, in any experience of God through Israel. I am the fulfillment. That's who I am. That is the significance of the Transfiguration. That is why I think you've got Moses and Elijah there. It's Jesus saying, this is who I really am. I am the fulfillment of every piece of revelation that you have seen so far. And I'm going to take it further. It's exciting stuff. There are other more subtle things. Elijah handed his ministry over to Elisha. Elisha is a variant on the name Yeshua, Joshua. What was the name of the person that Moses handed his ministry on to? What was his name? Joshua. Yeah? So Elisha handed on to Joshua. Moses handed on to Joshua. What was Jesus' real name? Joshua. Yeshua, meaning God save. God saves. So another little subtle thing there. Fourth question. Why were Peter, James, and John told not to tell anyone? If you've been around St. Bees for any length of time, you've probably bumped into this before, but this might be new for you. Why would Jesus say, we've had it twice in this evening's scripture readings, why would Jesus say, I don't want you to tell anyone? Keep this quiet. Peter was told really in harsh terms how Jesus spoke to him, because Peter was thinking in worldly terms. Jesus started to say, I am going to be killed and then I'm going to be raised to life. And Jesus like, whoa, Jesus. That's not what we want about from our Messiah. Peter had a worldly understanding of what the Messiah was. And Jesus could see that people, even his disciples, had set ideas about who the Messiah was. People had set ideas about what kind of Messiah would ride into Jerusalem. I'll tell you who he was. It's a Messiah on a white charger with a sword who's going to go and kill the Romans. That's the Messiah that they were waiting for. How did Jesus ride into Jerusalem? On the foal of a donkey, riding in to die. Disciples are like, whoa, No, Jesus, I think you've misunderstood this. That's not the kind of Messiah that we're expecting. And Jesus is saying, that's the kind of Messiah you've got. And so Jesus wanted to say to his disciples, I want to show you this much, but I don't want word to get out. Because if people start to hear that the Messiah is here, and they pair that up with the miracles, they, like you, Peter, who was speaking in sync with Satan, they, like you, will be thinking, aha, we're going to get this Messiah and we're going to warp him and even possibly thwart his mission. He is the kind of Messiah who rides into Jerusalem to die, not to flash a sword. And so we call it the Messianic secret. The Messianic secret, and you noticed it particularly in Mark, where Jesus is saying, I want to show you these things, I want to show you these things, but you must stay quiet about them until after I have died and come back to life. You've got to be shtum until you've seen the end of the story. So those would be my answers to those four questions. I hope you found that interesting. Sometimes we're told at St. Barnabas there's not enough Bible study in the sermons, so I thought we'd do a Bible, more of a Bible study one. Today. I'll go back to telling jokes and stories next time we meet, if you don't like these ones. The Transfiguration, a fascinating, mysterious, secret revealing of who Jesus really is. It's anticipated by his baptism. It anticipates his death. It's right at the center of the synoptics. It's a vital part of saying Jesus is the fulfillment of everything God has and will do. This is who he is. And you need to know a little bit about the scriptures and the culture of that time to really unpack what's going on in the Transfiguration. Final question. So what is the Lord saying to us through this today? Why is the Transfiguration important to us today, this evening? Why does it matter? Well, to answer that question, I want to head back to the thing I mentioned right at the beginning. Remember I said at the beginning that in all three accounts, the Transfiguration follows the most important question a human being ever has to answer. That question is this. Mark 8, verse 29. Jesus turned to his disciples. There are lots of theories. Who do people say that I am? They say this, they say that, they say the other. What about you? Jesus asked his disciples. Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? I wonder what your answer to that question is. Transfiguration shows us in cultural, theological terms. But it's a question that we have to ask and answer at a deep, gut-felt level. I believe once we answer that question, it will define everything for us. The answer to that question will determine whether or not we live for eternity, whether or not we inherit the gift of eternal life. Between now and eternity, the answer to that question will define every moment, how we cope, what we think, what we do, what we say. Who do you say that I am? So I'm going to invite Andy to come back up, and I want to try a spiritual exercise. They happen in other traditions, this is a helpful spiritual exercise, one that I do, and who knows, if you like it, you might end up doing it for the rest of your life. If you don't like it, you may never do it again. But I'm going to invite you to sit straight, sit comfortably, and close your eyes. And Steph, can we keep that question up? Thank you. And right now, what I want you to do is call to mind the biggest challenge that you are currently facing. What is the biggest challenge in your life? What's going on with you at the moment? It might be one that everyone knows about. It might be something that only you and God are aware of. Involve a person. What is the biggest challenge facing you right now? I just invite you to call that to mind and sit and reflect on that challenge. How is it that that challenge challenges you? How is it that it stresses you? How is it that it seems insurmountable? Or just keeps nagging at you? And now in the light of that challenge, I'd like you to picture Jesus looking at you. Face of Jesus, eye to eye with you right now. And kindly, but maybe with just a bit of mild sternness in his voice, in the midst of the difficulty, Jesus is now asking you, who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? In the light of this difficulty, in the light of this challenge, Jesus is asking you that question. Who do you say that I am? Third part of this spiritual exercise is for you to answer Jesus in the light of this challenge. Jesus, this in the light of what is not yet right, this is who I say you are. Circumstance to quickly recall and answer that question. And Jesus asks us, yes, in the light of this, in view of that, who do you say that I am? Because I believe, Lord, how we answer that question will determine and define everything. We believe about you, what we think of you, who we think you are, will determine and define how we live our lives, how we respond to the challenges. Come, Holy Spirit. Come and help us, Lord. Keep that image of you, the transfigured Jesus. As we go from this place, maybe straight back to the challenge we just thought about, and maybe that lies in our path on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. As we go from this place, help us, God, to go with that question. Who we say Jesus is. Prophetic words. I'm going to do a bit of praying, is that right?
So